Okay, so hopefully this is going to be quite informal. I wasn't sure who was going to come, so I had a couple of slides just on the introduction of helium and neon isotope geochemistry. Should I go through that, or?
It's helpful.
Yeah, helpful. Okay. So we have two isotopes of helium, helium-3 and helium-4. Helium-3 is primordial, which means it's not produced in the Earth. Helium-4 is produced by radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. The key thing to remember is that helium is incompatible, which means that it's going to prefer the melt over the mineral. And that means that the residue of the melting is going to be severely depleted in helium-3. And there's another key fact which we'll come back to later, which is helium does not get recycled back into the mantle. And that's because the helium is lost primarily through degassing at ocean ridges, and then it's lost from the basalt as it weathers, and then further it's released from the oceanic crust as the plate gets subducted back into the mantle. So this is actually a fairly good assumption that there is no helium being recycled back into the mantle, which means that there's only a one-way transport of helium, which is always out of the mantle. And that's quite unique because none of the other elements actually behave this way. We believe that all the other elements actually get recycled back into the mantle as well.
Can I ask a quick question? George Bush tells us there's tremendous resources on the moon.
Yeah.
It's helium-3.
It's helium-3.
That's helium-3 embedded in...
In minerals like ilmenite from the solar wind.
Right.
Yeah.
So in principle, that can be recycled, right? Because it is embedded in a solid phase.
Yes, but the moment you start to heat it up, it's lost. Yeah. So that's why, so the other thing, maybe 15 years ago, that Don Anderson proposed that subduction of interplanetary dust particles enriched in helium-3 explains all of the helium in the mantle. And that was shown not to work because people actually went and did diffusion experiments with these dust particles. And basically, by the time you reach temperatures of, say, even 100 degrees for periods of maybe only 100,000 years, all the helium is gone.
And helium is soluble in water, so the subduction of water...
It's actually fairly low. The solubility of helium in water is quite low. It's very low, actually.
From a mass balance perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the helium content of water in equilibrium with the atmosphere is roughly the same as the mantle.
Roughly.
Well, with a factor of 10.
Yeah.
So, in fact, achieve subduction of water, I think that you could perhaps carry some helium in that. It's a matter of where the water is sited, whether helium is going to play mineral sites, and blah, blah, blah.
That's right, yeah. I mean, unless you believe that there is a, that the water is subducted as pore fluids. If you subduct water into the deep mantle as pore fluids, then it's possible that whatever gases are in that water, you can subduct it back. But in general, if you look at the isotope ratio of that pore fluid, it's going to be the atmospheric ratio. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be high 3-4 ratios. So that's another thing to keep in mind, yeah. Okay. So this is a summary slide that sort of shows what the isotopic composition is in mid-ocean ridge basalts, and basically people find that mid-ocean ridge basalts have a fairly homogeneous composition. For some idiosyncratic reason, the nomenclature for helium isotopes is kind of backwards. So normally any isotope geochemist would always write the radioactive species divided by the stable species, except for helium, it always was helium-3, helium-4, a practice that Harmon Craig started almost 40 years ago. But I think we are slowly reverting back to what makes more sense. But in any way, so the upper mantle has about 8 times atmospheric ratio. In this space, it's about 80,000. And ocean island basalts, places like Hawaii, Iceland, and Galapagos, have much higher 3-4 or lower 4-3. So these extend all the way to about 50 times the atmospheric ratio. And then there is another group of ocean island, known as the high mu ocean island, which actually have more radiogenic helium isotope ratio. So remember, this direction is more radiogenic in growth. So these are believed to be sampling some sort of a primitive reservoir, relatively anti-gas reservoir, whereas the HIMU basalts are supposed to be sampling a much more radiogenic reservoir, and it's been proposed that HIMU could be recycled oceanic crust. So if we look at the space here, HIMU basically stands for high mu, which is high uranium lead ratio. And the expectation is that, or rather we see that these basalts actually have fairly radiogenic lead isotope ratios. So in this space, this is 3-4, normalized to the atmospheric ratio, that's the Ra, versus strontium. So we have the HIMU basalts plotting down here, fairly low 3-4 ratios. This is the MORB, 8-Ra. And these are the ocean island basalts, which seem to be trending towards a reservoir that's somewhere up here, about 50 to 60 times the atmospheric. And maybe it's a bulk silicate earth composition is about 7045, somewhere up there. So it may be similar to bulk silicate earth composition. It might be depleted, probably depleted with respect to bulk silicate earth composition. But one of the things that I first wanted to do was to actually look into some detail as to what the HIMU ocean island basalts are doing, because recycled crust should have 3-4 ratios that are fairly radiogenic. So you should expect that these basalts not to be plotting here, but to be plotting right on this line, because there is no helium-3 that's getting subducted. So it should be basically pure helium-4. But we still find the values up here. So there's been a variety of models that have been proposed, such as you're basically seeing some sort of equilibration between the recycled crust and the MORB mantle, or that maybe there's something else that's pulling the 3-4 ratios up. And one of the things that we did recently was to actually measure neon, and I'll show you why neon provides a unique constraint on this. So let's talk a little about the neon isotope geochemistry. So for neon, we'll add one more isotope. There are three isotopes. So this is 2022. The thing to remember here is that these are stable isotopes. So nothing in the mantle actually changes with respect to 2022. So the mantle basically lies somewhere along here, along the solar composition. And you can actually move in the X direction because neon 21 is produced through nuclear reactions. And there are two major reactions that produce neon 21. One is basically an alpha N reaction on oxygen 18. So an oxygen 18 accepts an alpha particle, spits out a neutron, produces neon 21. And then the second reaction is on magnesium, and this is a reverse. This is an alpha reaction. But
where those reactions happen?
In the mantle. But the key thing to remember is, if you look at both of these reactions, notice that they're produced by alpha particles, or helium-4. So the production of neon 21 is actually very strongly coupled to the production of helium-4. Okay, and so basically the reason you can move in this direction is if you degas a mantle, you'll strip off the neon 22, and then through these nuclear reactions in the mantle, you can produce 21 and so move out in this direction. And so if you look at the mantle, basically we see that the MORB source lies somewhere up here, and then places like Louihi and Iceland lie up here. And that's consistent with the MORB coming from a degas reservoir and Louihi in Iceland sampling something that's relatively undegassed. And then the moment you start dealing with noble gases other than helium, you have to worry about air contamination. And so what happens is that these mantle compositions mix with air, producing these different trajectories or mixing lines. Okay, and so the way people actually establish the neon isotope ratio in the basalts is to actually take measured values and then extrapolate it up to the solar composition and then basically read off the 21-22 ratio. And that's because, again, nothing in the mantle really changes this ratio. And so the only reason you see variations in the ratio in the basalt is because of addition of atmosphere. Okay, and that addition probably happens when these basalts get erupted onto the seafloor.
That's a question. So I understand why the air is the far left in the 21-22 ratio, why is it to the left for 20 over 22? Why is it at the bottom of 10?
Up here? That's a whole separate issue that relates to how you produce the atmosphere. Basically, this is, if you have time, let me just digress for a minute.
If it's not interesting, keep going.
No, it is actually a very interesting problem, and it basically shows you that you can't degas the mantle and produce the atmosphere, because we know that the mantle is up here, right? So you have two choices to explain this ratio. You either say you degas the mantle very early on, and then you lose most of the atmosphere through hydrodynamic escape, whereby you have massive loss of hydrogen that also pulls out the neon and fractionates the isotope, and you have to do that very early on within, say, 50 to 100 million years of Earth history. And that fractionating loss will basically take the solar composition and drive you down. And if you notice, this basically lies on the mass fractionation line. The other way of explaining this is to actually say that this is coming from late addition of comets or even carbonaceous chondrites, because it turns out that carbonaceous chondrites actually lie on this. And again, they form the same mass fractionation line with the solar composition. So you can take this and add a little bit of atmosphere or degassed mantle volatiles and get the atmosphere.
Why does the carbonaceous chondrites have so low?
It's because the carbonaceous chondrites have most of the neon trapped in diamonds, and these diamonds are pre-solar diamonds. So they have not been processed earlier on in the solar system. And so the nebular gas actually has a different composition than all the little bits of stardust that was put into the solar system. And the solar system, or at least the carbonaceous chondrites, keep a memory of what was added into the molecular cloud, which then collapses to produce the solar system.
Because they're in the diamond, they're not, I mean, because these are volatile rich, and so they haven't felt the, I don't know, violent impacts to volatilize them. So I don't know, it just seems like it would be higher, or?
You mean why the diamonds keep the ratio?
Well, the diamonds are.
Carbonaceous chondrites have never been carved.
They've never been carved, right. Yeah. So that's why I would have expected that here.
But I guess the question is why you don't also see all the solar volatiles too, because they shouldn't have been lost. So you should have the pre-solar material plus.
But the solar material is, this is a gas, right? This is in the gas phase. So the carbonaceous chondrites can't trap the gas that easily. Right? So we know that most of the, like if you plot the composition of the Allende meteorite against the solar composition, you see that they all lie on the one-to-one line except for volatiles and noble gases.
But there's also a bunch of meteorites that fly above solar, so-called neon B.
Oh, no. Neon B is down here. Not above solar. There's nothing above solar. Yeah. So it's basically that the gas actually has a different origin than the diamonds. And the meteorites are sampling the diamonds, and looks like the Earth got at least some chunk of the solar or nebular gas. So this is, as I said, this is actually a problem, because no one really has a good explanation for how to generate all of the noble gas compositions in the Earth atmosphere self-consistently. You tie yourself into sort of hopeless knots. You explain neon and you can't do argon and xenon, or you do xenon and you can't do neon and argon. Okay, so again, the thing to keep in mind is that as you degas reservoirs will be to the right-hand side here, and relatively undegassed would be onto the left-hand side. And so this is some actual data here. So these are MORP samples. And again, they define this linear trend because you're mixing the upper mantle composition with air during eruption, producing this trend. And then places like Louis in Iceland define these straight lines up here. And the key is that if, as I said, the helium-4 production is coupled to the neon-21 production. So high mu basalts have more radiogenic helium isotopes, so you would expect that high mu basalts would actually be to the right of the so-called MORB line up here. So they should be plotting in this region. Okay? So So that's sort of the expectation. And so we actually measured some samples from the Cook Austral Islands up here in the South Pacific. And this is the very sort of characteristic isotope compositions you see for high mu. So that's sort of the MORB range. That's more radiogenic. And in the Cook Austral Islands, you actually find sort of more enriched compositions, very closely associated with these high mu lavas. And
the horizontal axis simply.
Simply, sorry, you can't see, these are the locations. So Raibawai, Mangaia, Tibuai, these are the islands. So when we measured the neon, it came out to be quite surprising. This is the air MORB mixing line. And all of the neon isotope compositions are actually to the left up here. So they're less nucleogenic than the MORB source. And so this basically surprised us because it meant that the helium in the so-called high mu lavas do not result from mixing recycled crust and the upper mantle. It must mean that you're sampling some other reservoir that is relatively undegassed. And as far as we know, there is only other there's only one other locality where neon has been measured, and that's in the Cameroon line. And so these are the gray diamonds, the black diamonds up here. So this is sort of the upper mantle composition. And basically, these are our measured values up here. This is the one sample that we have from Rapa, which is more enriched. And basically, as you see, that for most of the samples, except maybe these two, the neon is less nucleogenic than MORB. And we can explain this if we start off with something that's relatively undegassed. So this is a 3-4 ratio that would correspond to about 16,000 or about 50 Ra and solar 21-22, and we mix it with recycled crust and you can generate these signatures. So one of the things that we wanted to see is, can you self-consistently explain basically all of the isotope systematics this way? And that's one of the reasons we went to the Cook Australs, because it's very well characterized. This plot was maybe just for Stan. So even though we only have a few samples, we sort of see a correlation between the lead and the neon. So basically, recycled crust is up here. So more radiogenic lead, 206, 204, and more nucleogenic 21-22. And so as the ratio decreases, or as lead becomes less radiogenic, the neon also becomes less radiogenic. So that looks like it's something, there's some reservoir down here, about between 18.5 and 19, that's sort of what the so-called FOSA composition is.
It also suggests that as you go to extreme high mu,
yeah,
you're approaching more of 21-22.
No, well, basically, this is not going to be a straight mixing line, right? You're going to have a...
Just go to the far right, the Mangaia sample,
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
That is the same 21-22 as MORB.
Actually, MORB, the MORB is up here. This EPR MORB actually is from 13 to 24 south, where you also see high 3-4 ratios. So I didn't actually eliminate those samples. So the EPR actual MORB compositions are up here.
Extrapolated MORB or real MORB?
Extrapolated MORB.
Okay, but maybe yeah, we shouldn't extrapolate it. What's the highest real MORB in MORB in 21-22?
These are all extrapolated. These are all extrapolated. Because extrapolated means, remember that...
it's an arcane thing we do. Just
well, it's a disturbing word.
It's, it's basically saying that your
see.
Compositions are a mixture of the real mantle composition and air. So you,
yeah,
so the extrapolations mean you're extrapolating it to a solar composition.
Okay,
so you just...
The crux is, where does that Mangaia sample plot on a 3 isotope? Did you show us that?
Yeah, I think I did. There. And in this plot, MORB would be way up over here. Anyway, so I think what we're trying to do is just basically show that there's a consistency in explaining all of the systematics. So this is osmium, strontium, neodymium, lead. And one of the things we said is that we have some understanding of what the osmium, strontium, neodymium and lead compositions in the FOSO end member is and what is in the recycled crust. But we really don't have a good idea of what the helium concentrations are because those can be affected by degassing. So what we did was we basically fit the data. So this is the more enriched compositions up here, and this is the so-called high mu lavas, and we fit the data. And then that basically defines the helium concentration contrast between the two end members, and then we propagated that concentration contrast into these figures. So basically it's at least internally self-consistent. We are not using different abundances of helium for these different mixing calculations. And I think to a first extent, or to a first order, we basically capture the measured compositions. Now we know that no single ocean island can be explained by a simple mixture of two components. There's always additional components, such as maybe recycled sediments, so on and so forth. But basically, at least to a first order, we can explain this by mixing a relatively undegassed mantle with recycled crust. And so... Yeah.
That's way far from anything we would call a degassed mantle.
So, sure.
Not even remotely like FOSO. It's almost all gray.
Yeah, so this is stuff that I took off from Matt's paper, where he has FOSO A and FOSO B.
I mean, FOSO B.
This is composite. FOSO B is somewhere between. I thought I didn't want to go into that.
Yeah, no, don't bother.
But basically, the other thing to remember is that we can make these compositions. Like if we selected something up here, we could certainly explain these, the high
mean. Because then they're the same.
Yeah. But you wouldn't, I mean, if you select something that's up here, you wouldn't be able to capture these data points. Now, it's possible that actually what you have in the Cook Australs is a little bit of sediment. Right, and so because we are basically doing a two-component mixture, we had to take this composition.
The triangles again,
the triangles? That's RAPA. But the only thing I really wanted to show was that you can self-consistently get a mixture of something that's relatively undegassed and recycled crust. And it turns out that I think that that neon might be actually a key in trying to figure out whether you have subduction into the lower mantle or into the upper mantle. Because if you have subduction into the upper mantle, then you would expect the neon to be lying between the morp composition and recycled crust. Whereas if you have subduction into the lower mantle, you would expect the neon to be lying between recycled crust and the undegassed mantle.
Back to the three-isotope plot that has all of the data, which is not nearly as impressive as yet. Remember the Mangaia plot on that, and realize that we kind of hooked slightly above the Moore line.
So it would be basically similar to what you get at Shona. So up here.
So it's almost not statistically outside range of
almost not, yeah. But the only thing to remember is that even if it actually falls on the morb, even then you can't explain it by mixing morb and recycled crust because you still need it.
There are morb with 7RA, which we don't understand.
Yeah, but those actually have normal-looking lead and normal-looking neon. So they would plot often in this on this line, or even actually to the right of this line, but usually not to the left of the line.
So RA is
the ratio.
In the atmosphere.
RA is the ratio in the atmosphere, yes.
These measurements are made on a whole rock, right? You take a whole rock, you grind it up, you release gases.
Yes. For most of these are actually basalts. These are. So what you do is you take a basalt glass and you crush it and release
the
gases.
Where does the air contamination come from?
It's basically assimilation. So we believe there are maybe two or three steps in this. One is when you erupt the lava, you assimilate seawater. And seawater will have dissolved air.
Yeah, But you started by telling us there's no way of recycling noble gases, right?
Or very, very little. Okay. And actually, it's true that you probably do recycle some of the heavier gases, but not so much helium and neon, because this, as you go to heavier and heavier noble gases, their solubility also go up. So helium is the least soluble in water, and xenon is the most soluble in water. So if you assimilate some amount of seawater into the basalt on eruption, that's one way of introducing it. The other way that I think this happens is when you bring this up from, say, 3 kilometers of water depth to the surface, you basically can produce little tiny fractures through the shock, because sometimes this happens fairly rapidly as you pull it out from the bottom of the ocean. So that's a second way, maybe, that fracturing might be introducing air contamination into these rocks. And the third way I think this happens is actually in the lab when you're handling it. You're cleaning off some of the alteration in the basalt, you're sonicating it, and that might be injecting bubbles in.
And in something as old as Mangaia, you can actually diffuse helium in at room temperature enough to kick it down a little bit. When they worried about this in the war days and made the argument that at 3 degrees centigrade things were okay in glass.
Okay. So in Mangaia, these are subaerial eruptions, so we had to make the measurements in olivines. So olivine diffusivity at room temperature is really low. And so no hope.
Well, those three things you talk about, the first two worry me a little bit with respect to your assumption on the first slide, right? If it's a reaction between seawater and the glass that gives you this much extra noble gases, mm-hmm. You do recycle noble gases.
Yes and no. So the thing is, that ultimately this is determined by the contrast in concentrations between the mantle and what's in seawater, right? So in helium, the reason why we don't see it is because the helium content of the atmosphere is so low. And you see this even more for argon. So for example, you can basically have measurements that are approaching solar and the argon can look like air, because 1% of atmosphere is argon. And so the heavier the noble gas, the more air contamination we see. And that is sort of consistent in terms of your expectation of air contamination. Now, there's other arguments you could use to say that at least helium and probably neon are not recycled. Because if you recycle helium and neon, then you also have to you basically change the helium-neon ratio in the mantle. So the helium-neon ratio in the mantle is about 3. The helium-neon ratio in air is very close to, it's basically 0.
There actually is helium in deep crustal material and peridotites, the lower part, post-melting.
Sure.
It's not trivial. I think the final argument that these don't get recycled is when you put them in a subduction zone.
Yeah.
If you've got anything that far, then you take it away. And that's almost an act of faith in that community, I think. So I think you can prove that there is residual helium left after melting. But then they magically wave it away when it goes down through the subduction zone and say, nothing gets through the subduction zone. I don't know how they know that.
Well,
you see mantle helium coming out of our volcanoes, right?
Well, yeah. But you have helium coming out, but is that all of it?
It's
mass balance is just.
I mean, the mass balance is hard because we don't know how much is coming out of arcs in the first place. But if you look at, say, altered basalts, or for example, if you look at Jurassic age basalts, and this was measurements done in the 80s. There are about 100 or 1,000 of what you measure in a fresh basalt. So we know at least that by the time that the plate is making its way down into the subduction zone, a very large fraction of what is being trapped in the basalt is being released. At least this is for the ocean crust. Now, if there's a fair bit of helium that's trapped deeper in the crust, then the chances of recycling that are certainly high. But at least I think in the ocean crust, there's not a lot of helium associated with the ocean crust that goes back down.
I would claim that there has never been the right measurements done. You know, the only measurements on old ocean crust are fairly shallow, so they're in the upper Pilauata sequence. And okay, that stuff is exchanged with seawater and probably extremely altered. The deeper parts, the abyssal peridotites and the gabbros, have only been drilled in relatively young crust. And those do have helium left. And so I wouldn't be able to say what happens to that helium by the time you get across the ocean.
Yeah, those do have helium, but again, if you look at the number of measurements that have been made, the average would still be at least a hundredth lower than what you find in the
4 × 10⁻⁷
CCs. Yeah. As opposed to 10 to the
popping rock is 3 × 10⁻⁵. So
no, 10⁻⁴. It's about 90 × 10⁻⁵. So it's still at least two orders of magnitude lower. So there still can be a lot, but relative to what's coming out, it's not going to be substantial. Should I proceed? Any more questions? Okay. So hopefully we can show at least that some of the Haimyu lavas basically sample the same component that you see at places like Galapagos, Hawaii, and Samoa. And so at least what we are seeing is that there appears to be one reservoir with relatively high 3-4 ratios, and that can basically explain the noble gas compositions of most of the ocean island basalts. And so both the both places like Hawaii and Iceland, as well as the high 4-3 OIBs like the Cook Australs, come from the same reservoir. And so the next two questions are, where is this material actually located, and how do you preserve these ratios? How do you preserve very high 3-4 ratios and high helium-3 concentrations, especially if you have a mantle that's convecting? Now, there is a good argument for having a volatile-rich reservoir from argon-40, and this was Claude Legge's argument. So if you look at the total amount of argon-40 that is produced from potassium, so our radioactive decay of potassium-40 produces argon-40, and so over Earth history, you should have this much argon-40, so about 140 to 156 times 10 to the 18 grams. And roughly half of this argon that's been produced over Earth history now lies in the atmosphere. So the other half has to be in the mantle. And basically, the amount of argon-40 that's in the morb, if you say that the whole mantle looks exactly like the morb source, then you would explain maybe 10% of this number. So somewhere between 6 to 8 times 10 to the 18, as opposed to 60 to 80 times 10 to the 18. So there's clearly some reservoir with much higher gas content than the upper mantle.
And for historical purposes, do people still treat this as a serious issue? So you don't worry about impacts blasting off lots of Earth's early atmosphere?
No, so this is why argon is neat, because the Earth starts off with zero argon-40. And it's only radioactive. So if you look at, say, meteorites, the 40-36 ratio of a meteorite at time zero was 0.001. So there is no argon-40 at time zero. So it doesn't matter.
Unless you can get rid of the first 500 million.
Yeah.
But in answer to your question, I think a lot of geochemists have given up this as a problem. But the time lag between us and the geophysicists means that the geophysicists are actually carrying this argument into the future.
Oh, geophysics is very slow to pick up on that.
Geochemical argument.
It'll take centuries.
Yeah. No, I think the key thing to remember is that you can't have a morph. You can't have the entire mantle looking like the morph source. You have to have some reservoir. And the argon constraint actually tells you that it can't be a small part of the mantle, that it can't be 1% of the mantle, or it can't be 1% of the lower mantle. It has to be substantial to explain this amount of argon 40. So that's why it's kind of a nice argument in some respects.
Well, in some respects, we know from strontium, neodymium, lead, everything else, all of the isotopes tell us that the whole mantle can't be the upper mantle.
That's right.
So this was like a non-issue.
That's right. So, and I'll come back to why a lot of people thought it was an issue. And that's because the assumption is that if you process a mantle reservoir, you lose all of the volatiles. So anything that is melted basically is gone. So assume that the whole mantle has been processed once through melting. That would basically mean that all of the argon that has been produced has been lost to the atmosphere. And so that's why there has been this argument that there is a largely undegassed reservoir that doesn't exchange or is not sampled by volcanoes at the surface. Because if you sample it, you will lose all of the argon 40. And so the noble gases have traditionally, or rather they were first used to really sort of put this picture. I think at this point nobody really believes this, and I think one of the fatal flaws is that if you have mass flux out of this box, then you need to have mass flux back into this box. So this can never be a completely isolated reservoir circulating like this. So this is clearly not the right picture. And as I said before, the argon 40 basically says that this is also not the right picture, where the whole mantle looks like the upper mantle. And some people have argued that that especially the high helium might be associated with a recycled lithosphere. And I think, again, the problem with this is that the recycled lithosphere is not going to have enough argon 40, and I also think it's not going to have enough helium 3 to maintain a high 3-4 reservoir. And so if you think that this is the way the mantle works, then you have a problem. So let's say this is our convective mantle reservoir. You sample a part of this mantle. So you have the melt and the residue. So you degas the melt. The residue is barren because helium is incompatible. So it's depleted in noble gases by at least 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. And let's say then you stick it back into the mantle. And then you sample another part of the mantle. And basically, this is now conduit for helium concentration. So this is high concentration. This is very low concentration. And so if this is the way that the mantle works, whereby basically you just keep sticking the slabs underneath, then by the time you have sampled all of the reservoir, there are no volatiles left behind. And so I think this is the picture that often people have when they say, well, in this case, what you need is a convectively isolated reservoir, or at least some part of this primitive mantle reservoir surviving through Earth history. Because if you sample all of it, clearly all of the volatiles are gone. There is no argon 40. The helium 3 has been taken out, so where is the high 3-4 ratio coming from? But I think that this is the wrong picture. So this is the work that Helga and I did, and it's now under review, where basically we said, well, what happens if you take this barren material and instead of sequestering it, what happens if you mix it back in? And again, now everything is sort of contoured, or this is the color contour, so high concentrations, lower concentration, and this one doesn't show up as well. This is actually not white, it's this gray color. So you take the slab back and you instantaneously mix it, then you dilute the gas concentration of the reservoir. And through this mixture, basically you don't have primitive material at any time step after time zero, because you're mixing in material that is not primitive. So
in the end member of immediately mixing it back in, mm-hmm. in that case, isn't this really just like taking the crustal component out and doing nothing else, keeping the reservoir well mixed?
Yeah.
But instead of taking the whole thing out, putting half of it back in.
Well, we're actually putting all of it back in.
Except the part you know that you've sequestered for the crust, continental crust, right, which is part of this.
No, in this stuff, the continental crust is not
doesn't exist.
No.
Okay, so isn't it then just like really removing helium and doing?
No, because if you just remove helium, so if you
same size box, take the helium out and just put the box back.
Put the box back, but you have to mix the box back in.
Yeah. You just said in the end member where you instantaneously mix it back.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it really just like removing helium continuously?
It is removing helium continuously. But what happens is, in this case, over time, the rate at which you are extracting helium is decreasing, because degassing, or basically when you melt a reservoir, so in this case, if you melt the reservoir, you'll have more helium-3 going into the melt, simply because the reservoir has a higher gas concentration. In this case, when you melt this reservoir, the amount of helium-3 that goes into the melt is much lower, because the gas concentration in this reservoir is lower.
Again, that looks like just a simple radioactive.
Yeah, basically, so if you simply write out the equation,
that's the equation, where it's
the concentration multiplied by the fraction that's being recycled times the processing rate. And so this is basically the solution, and if you say that the fraction being recycled is zero, then it's simply the concentration times e to the minus qt, where again, q is the processing rate and t is the time. And so this very simple equation shows you that if you assume that you have processed one reservoir mass, or a mass that's equivalent to the mass of this reservoir has been passed through the melting column in 4.5 billion years, then effectively this becomes C naught over E, which means that 40% of your starting volatile is going to be left behind in this reservoir after a mass that's equivalent to the mass of this reservoir has been melted. So that's a very simple argument. And basically, the reason that you're having about 40% remaining behind is because you're diluting the gas concentrations in the reservoir slowly over time. And therefore, the rate at which you're losing helium is also decreasing over time. So when you couple those two, you basically get a very large fraction of your volatile still being preserved. And one of the neat things that we would like to follow up is, in this case, if you say, well, 40% of the original helium is remaining behind, that also means that 40% of the original water and 40% of the original CO2 are also being left behind. So is that sort of clear as to what we did?
Except for the last two, right? There are other mechanisms to reintroduce water and carbon into them.
And that's why I said at least, right? Because you're putting more stuff back in. In this case, you only have 40% because you're not sticking anything back in.
I mean, basically, you can never get rid of the helium in this model. Whereas
that's right.
Is linear, and eventually you can pick a box.
That's right. And so, yeah, exactly. So by the time you have processed that whole reservoir, there is no helium left behind. Whereas in this case, it's an exponential decay.
Wait, so are you going to try and make the same argument for argon? So
yes.
To have the 50% left in the...
Yes. So it's basically the same argument, that it's the slow dilution of the gas concentrations that actually helps to preserve the argon as well. So the next thing that we did was we said, well, let's make it a little more complicated. Let's assume that maybe mixing is not instantaneous, but let's assume that there's a characteristic time over which the slabs mix back into the mantle. So this is basically the same scenario where you take the box, you melt it, you stick it back in. Notice that this box is now a little bit smaller than this one, and that's because only part of this slab has mixed back into the mantle. And so as you step through, and again, this is not showing up. Well, maybe you can sort of see it in here. You basically get different size boxes. So the oldest box up here is basically just the size of this dot. And the youngest slab in here is basically a big box here. And so
the convecting reservoir is homogeneous all the time.
Yeah.
And so you're just eating up the boxes, but immediately making the reservoir homogeneous.
Yeah, so basically what we're doing, we're only assuming, or rather we're assuming that this box or this reservoir is always staying homogeneous in composition, and that's certainly an approximation. But there are two reasons why we thought, at least initially, this was the way to do it. And that's the one thing is that basically, so long as this mixing time scale is much faster than the time scale at which these slabs mix into the mantle, this is still okay. And the other is we basically assume some very long characteristic mixing time that approach about 4 billion years, in which case basically a very small part of the mantle is basically this well-mixed reservoir, and in which case it's okay to assume that you're getting a homogeneous concentration because it's only a very small fraction.
So you're saying mixing in time for the slabs is almost 10 times, sorry, is a tenth of the mixing time of the ambient reservoir.
Or it's that this mixing time for the slab into the reservoir is much, much longer.
Or
yeah.
Order 10 times, 5 or 10 times.
Yeah. Okay, so basically what we're saying is that you'll have a whole bunch of different slabs, some that have much larger length scales and some that'll have very small length scales. And in this case, as you would expect, you would lose more of the volatile. So basically, now this is being this is the amount of helium in the mixed in the well-mixed reservoir as a function of the characteristic time.
Okay.
So
can you remind me again, is the mixing model for that is exponential also?
Yes. So it's the character. So this is basically the 1/E. Time constant. And zero is basically the instantaneous mixing. So that's the instantaneous mixing case up here in the dashed line. And this is now 4 billion years, 2 billion years, and basically if you assume the longer you make it, and ultimately as it approaches infinity, what you would get is, if it's infinite, you would be going along this line and then drop down to zero. So that's the extreme end member case. So in this case, even after you've processed a reservoir once, you notice that even for mixing time constants of 4 billion years, you can still have between, say, 30 and 50% of the original volatile in that reservoir still being preserved. And if you now look at it in terms of the whole reservoir and not just the mixed reservoir, so the whole reservoir is the mixed part plus the slab, so this is now again the instantaneous mixture, mixing. So the instantaneous mixing case, and this is the 4 billion years. So for this case, even after 4 billion years, you would still have 20% of the total inventory at time zero. So again, that's still substantial, and 4 billion years is a fairly slow mixing time constant, I think. And this is a figure that shows you what the proportions of the slab is as a function of the time constant. So this is the fraction of the reservoir processed and the unmixed slab. So if you have one reservoir mass that has been processed, and if your characteristic mixing time is about 4 billion years, then what you would have is about 70% of the slabs would not have mixed into the reservoir. So this would be approaching the case where basically it's a slab graveyard. So the slabs are just being subducted into the mantle and not mixing in. And so in the case up here where we build, so let's take the upper mantle. If you have mixing time constants of, say, 100 million to 500 million years, basically there's very little unmixed slab in the upper mantle. Most of it has been mixed into the ambient mantle. Now, to actually see if this works for helium isotope ratios, we actually need to now do some box models. We can't rely just on the analytic expressions. So what we did, we basically took this scenario and constructed two boxes, upper mantle and a lower mantle. And we said that the upper mantle melts to produce a slab. The slab is the crust plus the residue. And you extract uranium, thorium, potassium, helium, and argon from the upper mantle. And then when you subduct it back, you subduct uranium, thorium, potassium, but not the helium and the argon. Again, this is an approximation. And likewise for the upper mantle, you take uranium, thorium, potassium, helium, argon out and just stick uranium, thorium, potassium back in. And notice that we explicitly are not modeling any mass transfer between the lower mantle and the upper mantle. But this sort of is implicitly accounted for through the value of Q, or the processing rate. And the reason is that if you take depleted mantle and you stick it into the lower mantle, then basically it means that you've increased the processing rate of the lower mantle. And likewise, if you take lower mantle material and stick it into the upper mantle, that basically means you have decreased the processing rate of the upper mantle. So it's being implicitly accounted for, though we don't explicitly model the mass transfer. And then I guess you guys actually see these lower lines? Okay, so.
Sit up straight.
So what are the processing rates that Coltis and Ricard stuff get from their simulations? Is there another control on what they may be?
What are the processing rates?
They use Mason calculation for the parts of solving for that.
So, I mean, ultimately, the processing rates for the present day is tied to the Mohr flux and the plume flux.
Yes, the processing rate here is the rate at which you melt the mantle. That's the processing rate.
Well, yeah.
The mixing rate.
Okay. So you mean the mixing time constant. Oh, the mixing time constant that they get for the lower mantle is on order of 1 billion to maybe 2 billion years. And for the upper mantle is on order of 200 million years. So what we do is we start off in both of these upper and the lower mantle boxes. We start up with bulk silicate earth, potassium, uranium, thorium, and we assume that the initial 3-4 is 120 times atmospheric. It doesn't matter if you want this to be much higher, corresponding to solar ratios of about 300. So when you're doing these box models, we actually have to account for the rate at which uranium, thorium, potassium are being extracted, and we sort of do 2N-member scenarios.
I thought you weren't extracting.
No, now we are, because now we have to deal with the 3-4 ratios.
The previous slide showed you putting it all back in.
So I was going to explain that up here. So we're assuming that the extraction is linear over time, in which case, basically, the cumulative amount of uranium, thorium, potassium in the crust would look something like this. So this is the linear crustal growth model. And in the other case, we basically assume that most of the uranium, thorium, potassium extraction is very early on in Earth history. And so that would be this cumulative curve up here. And so this would mean basically that about 80% of the crust has been generated by 3 billion years. And again, these are sort of the 2N-member scenarios. And so what about the recycling of these elements? So for the upper mantle, we say, well, we know what the upper mantle uranium and potassium contents are. So we say that for all of the simulations, we actually have to end up in the upper mantle with this amount of uranium and this amount of potassium, depending upon the Boy and Carlson estimate, or 3 ppb uranium and 6 ppm potassium, depending upon the Workman and Hart estimate. So we do the simulations again for these two scenarios. And then for the lower mantle, we say, we really don't have a good idea of how much uranium, thorium, potassium is in the lower mantle. So we say what we do is we allow all of the uranium, thorium, potassium to go back in, to allowing none of the uranium, thorium, potassium to going back in. So in one case, there is no recycling, and in one case, there is complete recycling. So that's, again, the two extreme scenarios you can pick. And again, for the processing rate, what we do is we pick, for the Mohr, we pick the present-day mid-ocean rich processing rate, and for the lower mantle, we pick the plume flux. And we say basically it increases exponentially, and that's the range of parameter space explored for the upper mantle. For the lower mantle, we say, well, it's constant over time to exponential increase. So again, basically just trying to explore a large range of parameter space.
The way you set the helium model, the gas model, also physically determine the crustal evolution model. Because if you assume that the continental crust is tied to that model, and it becomes an exponential model, as will the helium. So exponential crustal growth, 1 over exponential. Does that make sense, Randy?
Sorry, I got distracted.
Well, that would assume the crust grows very, very fast early on and diminishes exponentially with time.
There are certainly crustal models like that, yeah. But in the other case, we assume that the crustal model is linear over time, yeah. That it grows.
You're taking those two members and then exploring pretty much everything in between.
Yeah.
No, for the upper mantle, you're not picking in members, right? You were actually.
No, for the upper mantle, we are. For the lower mantle, we are letting it go between 0 and 1. Yeah. Because.
The crust comes out of the upper mantle, though, so.
That's right.
That should follow your helium model.
Yeah. Okay. So then what we do is we prescribe a processing rate, a tau, and then a certain loss of radioactive species, again, as I said, constant through time or exponentially declining over time. And then we say we know that we start off at 120 times atmosphere. And so what we do is we find the initial helium-3 that would then explain the upper mantle, the lower mantle 3-4 of 50 times atmospheric, and the upper mantle 3-4 of about 8 times atmospheric ratio. So we know that you're starting off here, and you end up at these two points, and so we find the initial helium-3 for that, based on those processing rate, the mixing time constant, and the loss rate of the radioactive species. And then the other constraint we imply is that for the upper mantle, the initial conditions that we are going to derive must overlap with the lower mantle, because we are assuming that the Earth started off homogeneously. And then for the lower mantle, we say that it has to explain the 3-4 ratios, the helium-3 concentration, as well as the argon paradox. So that's how we sort of narrow down the solution space. And so this is what it looks like. So that's the time, and this is the helium-3 content. And basically, the initial helium-3 that we derived basically span around this parameter space of about 10 to the 11 atoms per gram to about maybe 3 times 10 to the 11 atoms per gram. And just for reference, plotted is the concentration of carbonaceous chondrite. And this is sort of the value you would get for the lower mantle if the lower mantle had evolved as a closed system. So if you take the 50 RA and you work out what a closed system should have, then you should have start off with this amount of helium-3. And then the present-day helium-3 in the lower mantle is about here, and this is sort of the estimate that we derived based on our previous work on OIBD degassing. So basically, the lower mantle has slightly higher helium-3 contents than what we derived from our OIBD degassing model. And then for the upper mantle, we basically get present-day helium contents that overlap what we believe is the helium-3 for the upper mantle based on the ocean flux. So the way this works is that we know that there's about 1,000 moles of helium-3 in the ocean. And if you take the mantle processing rate, that basically gives you the amount of helium-3 in the MORB source. So because, again, there is very little helium-3 in the atmosphere, so that 1,000 moles of helium-3 in the ocean is all coming out from degassing of the upper mantle. So again, it's consistent with what we observe. And so in terms of the solution space, basically the 3-4 ratio and the helium-3 content can be explained if the upper mantle has been processed an order 3 to 5 times, and the characteristic mixing times are basically instantaneous to about 500 million years. And then for the lower mantle, to get these initial helium-3 and the final helium-3, you basically have processing rates on order of 1/2 the reservoir mass to 1 time the reservoir mass, and mixing time constants of, or characteristic mixing time constants of 250 million years to about 4 billion years. So a fairly, again, large range of parameter space.
So it's really insensitive to the mixing time of the main reservoir, is that?
The mixing time of the well-mixed reservoir.
Yeah. is 0.254.
That's the time constant of the, or the characteristic mixing time of the slab into the well-mixed reservoir.
So it doesn't care.
I'll actually show you, it does, because with these higher values, you approach the lower amount of processing. And I'll show you one case for argon, actually. So this is what it looks like for argon-40. So this is the amount of argon-40 that should be present in the lower mantle. So that's just taking the amount of argon-40 that has been produced over Earth history, subtracting off what's in the atmosphere. Basically, there's nothing really in the morb. That's the amount you should have in the lower mantle. And so again, we can capture that amount of argon-40 with this kind of a solution space. And this is the lower the upper mantle solution space, and that's again the amount of argon-40 that's in the upper mantle based upon the helium flux. And again, the way this works for the helium is we know what the helium to argon ratio in the mantle is. So once you invert the helium flux to a helium concentration in the upper mantle, that also tells you what the argon concentration in the upper mantle has to be. So this is now the case for argon-40. And again, shown are two N-member cases. One is, the blue is where we actually recycle all of the uranium, thorium, potassium back into the mantle. And then the red is where we recycle none of the uranium, thorium, potassium back in. So basically, all of the, it's again a one-way transport out of the lower mantle. And so this is the processing, or the number of reservoir masses that has been processed over 4.5 billion years against the mixing time constant. And so if you recycle nothing, then basically you can process up to maybe 0.4 times the reservoir mass. And once you start putting more of the potassium back into the mantle, you can tolerate higher amounts of mantle processing in the lower mantle. Again, so these are the two extreme N-member scenario. And from simple mass balance, you know that this can't be true, that you can't just take potassium out of the lower mantle and not stick any back in. Okay, so basically I think what this shows is that you can have high helium-3 concentrations, high 3-4 ratios, and very high argon-40 concentrations in a mantle reservoir that is convecting, that is not isolated. And what we believe is that there is a single reservoir that is carrying these primitive noble gas ratios, and that's why I started off with the so-called high mu story, because I really think that all of the ocean islands are basically getting their noble gas from this one reservoir. And then the range of 3-4 ratios that you sample in the ocean islands basically reflect different proportions of this well-mixed reservoir and then these unmixed slabs. So basically, if you have a higher proportion of the unmixed slab in the volcano, you'll basically have lower 3-4 ratios. And if you have a higher proportion of the well-mixed material, then you'll have a higher 3-4 ratio. And so we believe that this might actually explain the spectrum of measurements that has been made. But obviously, to see if that's consistent, we would actually have to now introduce some sampling function, and we have to tie that into the length scale of the heterogeneities.
So our Pacific 3-4 ratio is higher than everywhere else?
I'm sorry?
Our Pacific ratio, so whether it's more slab, higher or lower than everywhere else?
You mean in terms of ocean islands? I don't think, well...
Ocean islands?
The
ocean islands come from the globe, so they don't care.
I mean, but in the Pacific Basin. So if you look at the hotspots that are in the Pacific versus Indo-Atlantic or Iceland, are there systematic differences?
I don't think so. No, I mean, Iceland has the highest measured 3-4 ratio. Samoa has values that are getting up to 35 now?
34.
So fairly high. So I don't think there is a systematic difference, but it's statistics of small numbers, surely.
But there could be a difference in the upper mantle reservoirs, because mixing time is very short compared to the plate time.
Mm-hmm.
So one might perhaps expect some difference between Atlantic and Pacific in the fourth.
There is no difference in the mean. There is a difference in the standard deviation. Well, I think there is in the...
It depends on how you filter the plume contaminated morphs. And if you look at N morphs sensu stricto, there's virtually no statistical difference between slow spreading, fast spreading, ultra slow, ultra fast.
Yeah, I think, let's not get into that.
Flooded N morphs from the PetDB database and the Lamont database. There was certainly a variance for the two N morphs. I mean, this was 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
My impression is that there was a difference, but if Stan thinks there isn't, then...
I trust you more than me.
It's probably the PetDB bias in that they haven't filtered for N morphs.
It critically depends on how you're filtering, so I'm not sure we want to go into that. So what does this mean in terms of the stuff that we had done? Basically, what we've shown is that you don't need any of the noble gases to come from the core. So that's often a favorite place to stick in the helium and the argon is the core, or the D double prime, because people have not been able to previously explain how you have a convective reservoir and high concentrations of these gases. So I don't think you need the core or the D double prime or any of the hidden enriched reservoirs. And basically, the noble gas signatures are compatible with there being a more processed upper mantle and a less processed lower mantle. And so does that mean that it's whole mantle or layered mantle convection? I don't know. But basically, it means that you can have substantial mass flux across the transition zone. And I think the key is throughout, because it means that you can have continuous flux of slabs across the 660 or 670. And you can have an exchange that's equivalent to the mass of the lower mantle. And although I didn't sort of go into it, because the lower mantle has been processed, it's depleted in isotopes. So you wouldn't expect the isotopic signature to look like primitive mantle. You should expect it to look somewhat depleted. And that's sort of the composition of FOSO. Except in our view, FOSO doesn't have to be produced early on in Earth history. It can basically have evolved continuously through time, because we don't require the way we preserve all of the signatures is by mixing slabs back into this reservoir.
For the range of parameters that you ended up with happy models, what would the range in mean age of the lower mantle be?
Well, the mean age of the lower mantle, I don't know. I can tell you off the top of that.
I mean, if you just averaged all your boxes, it would probably be, 2.5 billion years, I think.
Could be. 45,000 boxes.
Can we interpret the processing time in terms of an age? So one processing time is 2 billion years?
Roughly.
So anywhere between 500 million years and 3 billion years.
Yeah.
Was compatible with what you showed.
For the lower mantle.
Okay. Yeah. Right, for the lower mantle.
Yeah.
With 2 billion years right in the middle.
Yeah, I never said FOSO was likely to be ancient. Just a statement that, for example, if you took depleted a reservoir, I think I said early on.
Yeah, early. Yeah, but basically, I think you don't need to have it isolated for any length of time. It can have evolved continuously, and I think the key here. So you know, even though we did this box model, and the box model turned out to be a little more fancy than we wanted. Basically, the idea is still the slab subduction and mixing noble gas depleted slabs back into the mantle. That's sort of the key in preserving high concentrations of volatiles.
I mean, actually, the next step for you or for somebody is to tie the rest of the isotopes.
Absolutely.
Because this ancient thing will, I think, rear its head again, and you won't be able to successfully get the right strontium or neodymium. The same parameter space that you ran for helium and argon. So it will refine that.
It'll refine the parameter space further. I mean, the more you add in, the smaller the parameter space is going to get. Yeah. But it also will depend on the so-called recycling efficiency, like how much strontium and neodymium go back into the lower mantle. Yeah. 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 No, but you're right. I mean, that's one of the first things we would like to do. We'd also like to introduce the so-called sampling function, because if you have lens scales of, if you have boxes of different lens scales, you can make predictions for what you should see at the surface.
Do you have a right cartoon?
No. So I can only tell you that this is not the cartoon and this is not the cartoon.
You can draw a cartoon.
You showed us a bunch of cartoons, right?
I can, yeah.
In previous slides.
So if you were going to define a sampling function, if you look at mid-ocean ridges around the world, particularly the East Pacific Rise versus the Mid-Atlantic, so one place you have the majority of the Earth's melt production happening, everywhere else very little. How do you think about this sampling issue?
I think Stan said it right. It's 10 years of work.
Yeah. Intuition about that.
Yeah. We actually haven't.
Fast running ridges will have slightly larger sampling volumes, more, say, 10 to 20 kilometers of sort of homogenization. And the slow spreading ridges, it could be, depending on where the fracture zones and the discontinuities are, it could be as small as 5 or 10. I think
not
smaller.
But your model would be consistent with, it certainly requires different mixing times for upper mantle and lower mantle.
Yes. So
that would be consistent with some impeded flux.
Absolutely, yeah. Because that, absolutely, you can't have the whole mantle convecting like a pot of boiling water.
Sort of boiling slabs. Sorry, pumping slabs.
Yeah.
Well, they boil sometimes. Pumping slabs and reabsorption of some of the material into the upper mantle, and then perhaps some avalanche where they fall into the lower.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have impeded flow across this layer, then you can't explain how you end up with only one reservoir mass being processed in the lower mantle and about 3 to 5 times in the upper mantle. You have to have different processing rates. But what it means is that you do have substantial exchange across this boundary.
But implicitly, what you're saying is some slabs don't get through into the lower mantle directly, and some do.
Some do, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not true, is it? It just means they move more slowly in the lower mantle. Yeah,
no. I mean, it moves slowly, but basically not all of the slabs that are going down are getting into the lower mantle, in our view. Some of them are going into the lower mantle, but some of them are just mixed into the upper mantle. Yeah.
If you don't mix them into the upper mantle, then you require lower mantle, upper mantle mixing later on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can never deplete the upper mantle.
Yeah, that's principle. That's a way to set one of your stirring times, right? So you take the top picture and you pond some slab on the top because you have a fast trench migration speed. And you have to stir it in before it goes unstable and falls into the lower mantle. So that may be a way to set a bound on what the mixing time for the upper mantle.
Yeah, there's also another way that you very effectively sample the upper mantle, which is migrating mid-ocean ridges. Right? So the mid-ocean ridges migrated roughly 2 to 3 centimeters per year. And so that's basically sweeping over the top part of the upper mantle and sampling the uppermost roughly 100 kilometers.
Go back to what Stan said, so I'm not sure I quite understand. So lots of slabs get mixed up in the upper mantle, some slabs get mixed up in the lower mantle. That doesn't mean that some slabs don't make it into the lower mantle and more slabs stay in the upper mantle, just that much of the slab gets mixed up in the upper mantle and a smaller fraction of slab gets mixed in the lower mantle. So we can still have one slab going all the way top to bottom, where much of the mixing happens in the upper mantle and a smaller amount in the lower mantle.
All I was saying was some slabs have to mix in the upper mantle and some have to mix in the lower mantle.
Okay, and I'm wondering whether that's... some fraction of the... some of the slab mixes in the upper mantle and a little bit mixes in the lower mantle. Not that some slabs are in the upper mantle, some are in the lower mantle. But of a given slab...
And we're just arguing about the fraction.
I think it's more in the upper mantle at this current time.
Yeah.
Stretching more of that.
Yeah. why would the slabs on their way down know what the mixing time was, and why would that tell them
they're
whether
falling
they're
falling down through the rock? Because they're moving faster. Yeah, they're moving down at one speed, and the math is stirring at another. So it's a battle, right? It's whether the slab gets turned over before it falls down. That's what I was saying about it. It's a way to set your mixing time.
Yeah.
The story you're telling here is consistent with geodynamic studies, right, that have a more viscous lower mantle.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's the simplest possible geochemical model I've ever seen. It's consistent with, if it's geochemistry, it's a thermophysical model at the same time.
Geochemists have always had this model.
Except for the noble gases.
Well, they've never been able to.
They've not been able to.
The model, starting at least in '86 with this aluminum part, was exactly this: two-layer convection, part of the time, but not all of the time, and stuff going through some of the time, but not all of the time. And basically, any models and mixing stuff in both.
Put top on them, yeah. Yeah, but basically, but it's the problem with that noble gas people had with that was, how do you explain the noble gas in that framework? And I think this is how you do it.
Because of the first model that you showed, where it would just be pulled out.
That's right. So if you're never mixing the slab back in, then you can't preserve high gas concentrations. And so in our model, actually, there is no primitive mantle at any given point of time. You start with primitive mantle, but the moment you mix anything into that reservoir, it's no longer primitive.
And again, we know that. Well, we haven't known that there isn't any. We've known that we've never seen it.
Yeah.
Accurate.
Yeah.
So are there plumes still coming from core mantle boundary or not?
not in this. In this model, it doesn't matter, right? Because it's a box model.
Are there ocean island basalts that are old, billions of years old? Can you recognize them in the geologic record?
Well, perhaps. Yeah. No, but in the Archean, it's really, really hard.
It's hard. Yeah. Well, so the classic argument is the komatiites, right? That's often, or was in some cases, interpreted as plumes. And then Steve Parman and Tim Grove's idea is that it's subduction zones. Two very different viewpoints of a particular rock. So it's very hard to identify. It might be easier to identify the plume heads or the trap basalts. So those, I think, go back to maybe about 300 million years, but not billion years.
And characteristic of OIBs, pure alkaline basalts.
Yeah.
When you look for an alkaline, I mean, there are billions of alkaline basalts in the Archean, but almost none of them are alkaline.
Yeah.
So either they didn't exist or are in the melting conditions.
It's very different.
So I suppose that's how you test your last line. That you should see a time evolution of flow zone, if it's possible.
But you would see it irrespective, right? I mean, flow zone, even if it's...
You wouldn't be able, back then, everything converges. So
yeah.
Tell.
Right, because radioactive decay is, even if it's isolated, it would still be undergoing radioactive decay. Yeah, I mean, that would be one of the next things to do, is to tie in the strontium and the neodymium and see what comes out.
I'm going to suggest we stop here. Let's thank you formally.
Okay.